Got great ideas, but no idea how to build a website? Get Bluehost. Their AI design tool creates high-quality WordPress sites super fast. Whether you're a blogger, influencer, or launching a side hustle, Bluehost helps boost your growth with built-in marketing and e-commerce tools. Upgrade to cloud to get 100% uptime and 24/7 security to stay online all the time. Why wait? You've got the vision. Make it real. Visit Bluehost.com to get started.
Look at the screen. William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter. This is a podcast that is really behaviorally profiling Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's novel, Red Dragon, Manhunter, a scene at a time. And I have two beautiful, if you're watching on the video on the Patreon, two beautiful gentlemen who I want to grab because the last time I saw them, we were drunk as hell at the Blue Room in Los Angeles.
No, I was stone cold sober, my friend. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm leveling the accusations here. I'm holding the pen. I was there. To really help me unpack this, you guys, this has been broken up into 24 episodes, but not every single scene has an episode. We've got a couple of scenes that we're going. So by the time you're listening to this, with my great guest, this is the 17th scene as I've apportioned it in the show. We are really at the business end of this film. I am talking to two of my faves, Liam Billingham and Phil Gawthorne. They are diehard on a blank, and today they are here talking Manhunter and Michael Mann with me. Gentlemen, it's been too long.
Buddy, we miss you because we now have been with you in person.
Yeah.
It's like a real thing. You exist, and I know because every chance I got at that bar, I was like, "Where's Blake? I just need to get a hand on the guy."
Yeah, I can officially put it on recording. Is Phil as the requisite colonial? Walked up to me, Brit and Australian, and he's like, "Man, how are you feeling right now?" And I go, "You know better than almost anyone in this room." English, Australian. Yeah. How do you think of feeling? He's like, oh, you're just squashing it all down. Just squashing all those feelings down into a little box, into your heart. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I'm doing because I couldn't possibly deal with it. So thank you so much, gentlemen. I've been on your great show to chat about The River Wild. Katie Walsh has been on to talk about Heat.
You're both coming back.
We're coming back for one of Katie Walsh's guys, a Joel Schumacher phone booth, I believe.
Yes.
So glad you guys are on board for that.
I love that movie.
Okay.
I don't care what anybody says. I think it's great.
I saw it in the theater and I had a great time. I loved it because I was Colin Farrell pilled right from the beginning, post Tigerland, really, really Colin Farrell pilled. And so excited to go back and check it out. I haven't checked it out in a long time. I will for your show, of course. But we're here to talk about Michael Mann and we're here to talk about Manhunter. And I think that in the early episodes that some folk have been listening to and as we've been releasing them, I was genuinely, no matter how many times I've seen this movie, but going through the process of recording this show, I was genuinely excited and thrilled and kind of overwhelmed by Michael Mann in 1986 being in like God mode already. And so I would love to talk to you both about what this movie means to you and you know, your experience with it over the years, because I think before we get started into unpacking a minute, I'd love to hear. So take it away, either of you.
I have a feeling that Phil's relationship is longer and much more intense than mine. So I will go very quickly, which is I saw this movie in high school. I'd seen, you know, Silence of the Lambs. I think I was 9 when that came out. I saw it early. I went back. I started reading the Thomas Harris books. And I saw this movie. And at first I had the sort of cognitive dissonance that you have when it's not Anthony Hopkins playing the part. But I was pretty blown away by it. I've revisited it several times over the years. I have not seen the 70mm Michael Mann print here in LA. I'm dying to get to that. But I will say that when you reached out about doing this and we set up our minutes, I bought the movie on Amazon Prime. I was like, I should just have this in the pocket. I don't have the Blu-ray or anything like this. And I put it on and I was like, oh, this is just the greatest fucking movie ever made. Like, I really had like a transcendent, euphoric, and it could be the years of talking with you about Michael Mann. It could just be that it's in the ether, but like second feature, I mean, theatrical feature. And it's the most, I think, one of the most influential movies of the last 40 years. I just think it is a masterpiece. I mean, you know, among many, but this might be top 3 Michael Mann for me at this moment right now.
The 3 slot in the Michael Mann ranking is a real tough place to hang.
That's a
whole other podcast. And Screen Draws just did it.
Oh my god, yeah. I didn't even finish that yet.
And I know it was like,
I think they're still recording. Actually, I don't think they wrapped yet.
I don't think it's wrapped. I spoke to Clay. And I'm like, listen, you don't want me to be on that show. And I said, you got great people, but you would never have wanted me to be on that show. I said, because I would have vetoed everyone to death. There's only 2 slots that matter to me with the most brutal honesty that I can tell everyone. Heat is number 1, Insider is number 2. I don't care.
Yes. Okay. Well, Insider number 1 is Insider has always been my favorite Michael Mann movie. I think 2's got to be Heat. But then Public Enemies shows up and I'm like, I think this movie is incredible.
The 3 slot is Hell on Earth, cuz you've got Ben, right. You've got Thief, you've got Manhunter.
You know what else is good is Miami Vice. I don't know if Miami you guys Vice. Have seen that one, but no, it's
never seen it. Never seen it. That 3 slots Hell on Earth for Michael Mann fans. It's just, you know, you got Mohicans. It's just a nightmare. I don't even want to think about it, but that the top 2, I'm very kind of bullish on. Phil.
Well, to that point for me, Manhunter would be my number 2, with the precept that of course he is number 1. Collateral would be my number 3.
Yeah, you're exactly. Right.
There's just too many.
This is Insider erasure. Get out of here.
Too many perfect movies to compete. Yeah, you know, but if pressed, that would be my choice. As for my history with this movie, you know, I remember there was a cable channel in the UK that was actually called Bravo. It's very different to the Bravo that's here. That was a lot of sort of reality TV, real housewives stuff. But I remember them having a season of movies, and they were often those the like cult, you know, thrillers and stuff like that. This is when I was probably a teenager, and they had a double. The 2 of the films in the forthcoming season, which I think I'd never seen either of them at the time. One of them was Manhunter, and the other was To Live and Die in L.A. So I was Billy Peterson pilled at an early age, and he's become such a. I mean. That has to be one of the greatest 1-2 punch leading man breakthroughs, you know, in the history of cinema. So I thought he was just mesmerizing. And these characters, although they're both, you know, in To Live and Die in L.A., he's a Treasury agent, Secret Service agent. In this one, he's an FBI, both federal agents, but so different as characters. Richard Chance in To Live and Die in L.A. is so external and exudes that kind of external machismo and masculinity. Will Graham is a much more internalized character. He's still very masculine, but it's, you know, the characters have had such contrast.
To Live and Die in LA is 2 hours of Will Graham throwing Freddie Lowndes over the front of a car. That's basically what To Live and Die in LA is. That's the only hint you get. And then the rest is this fucking tortured soul unraveling in front of your eyes.
So this has been a hugely important film for me for as long as I can remember.
Did you get to the 70 mil screening, Phil?
You know, I had a couple. There was one that was a few years ago. It was at the New Beverly. It wasn't. Yes. It wasn't the one that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
On your first episode, when as you said that, I think Katie and some of the other guys described it very appropriately, and I totally get this as a religious experience because, you know, it is not only is it's a religious experience in the totality of experiencing this piece of art, but the film itself has kind of religious overtones. The other thing I was thinking about it though, especially with the organ music and everything, there's a lens through which you can see this film as a crazy musical, you know, because it's so post Miami Vice, MTV heavily influenced.
Now that's a musical I want to say.
Yes,
they're
absolutely.
So rare in cinema. Cinematic musicals are a tough hang. Just because they're really difficult, especially if you've seen a stage musical, because of the presence. You can't beat presence,
and you can't
beat the physiological thing that happens when you hear music in front of you. And it's so amazing. But
if I can tell one very, very brief anecdote that will probably sum all of this up and then move into the main thrust of the format of this. But to the point of the music and I was thinking about the whole, you know, dream much, Will, thing. One time in my life, I was so deeply immersed in Michael Mann, which I pretty much have been at varying degrees my entire life. But I was working on
it. Can't relate.
I was like, are you describing
I know this is a very esoteric. You guys, I don't know if you'll get this, but this kind of obsession. I don't know if you'll connect with it. But basically,
don't ever have a conversation with my wife. Okay, cool. Yeah, go on.
I was working on this neo-noir thing. So I was so, this because I'm a screenwriter and I was so immersed in it that Michael Mann, and this is really crazy, came to me in a dream, like a spirit guide, right? And said to me, this is absolutely true, because I had to write it down immediately afterwards. Usually dreams are such gibberish, you know, in the dream, like, you know, and goes, Phil, If you fuse together powerful images and powerful music, you will create a lasting cinematic experience. And I literally had to write that down, you know, because it was like this beacon of clarity in a world, you know, in this miasma of internal chaos. And it was like, wow, you know, and it really holds true. If you think about that, his movies are that powerful images. Powerful music, and that's why they have this. They have this massive imprint that someone like yourself is, you know, dedicating an entire podcast to every, you know, changing the format of an entire medium around a piece of art that he has created because it's that robust and that potent. And I think that Manhunter is on par with, you know, with the best work that he's ever done. So it's a hugely, hugely important movie to me. Personally,
can I add to that, which is like maybe this is like best saved for the end of the episode, but I remember when I saw this movie, I was working at the Video Scene, the video rental store in my hometown of Duxbury, Massachusetts, and you could take out all the old movies for free. So I'm like,
great perk.
Friday night, if it wasn't new, I could just pick up a stack of VHS tapes and bring them home. And that was like, you know, there was one TV in the house of the VCR, right? So my parents would go to bed and I would just stay up all night with headphones on watching movies. And so my first experience of this movie was like alone by myself at like midnight watching it, you know, downstairs.
Yeah,
you're
Will Graham with the Leeds footage
totally.
In his hotel room. Yeah.
And then I go to school and like, I was like a movie podcaster before that existed. So I would be like, guys, have you seen Manhunter? And all the people in school were like, what the fuck are you talking about? I watched, like, you know what I mean? Like, no, I was like already getting into movies at that point. So the fact that like 25, 30 years on, I'm talking about this on a podcast, just gives you the staying power of Michael Mann's work. Like I'm still thinking about it. And I was 14 when I saw this movie for the first time. They stay with you. They're like ghosts.
Yes. And sometimes it's just shots
that
wake you up in the night and they're disconnected from their context. But then
the
you're
vibe.
Like, and those connections though,
mm-hmm.
when you see them all together and they've just been swimming around in your subconscious, that's how you really kind of reconnect the resonant power of it. All right, well, let's dive in. We are. Folks at home, if you're trying to cue this up, if you're not watching the video, if you're there, Phil, Liam, and I are going to be talking about, and I know that there's people out there who, like me, have the great special edition with the director's cut. Right now, we're not talking about it because it's just not as readily available as a theatrical cut. So I've just been working exclusively off the theatrical cut for this series. There will be a couple of maybe bonus episodes where I talk about extended scenes, particularly one of the final scenes in the movie, because the endings are so radically different and they're so amazing. So that may come up, just in case you're wondering. But where we are today is 1 hour and 8 minutes and 53 seconds. It's basically Will and his stepson, or son in the movie. I'm not sure if it's rewritten, but in the book, it's his stepson. But so Will and his son in the shopping center together is the last frame of what we're looking at. And we are we're on the wharf with Molly, and then what I would call reflections in the rain. It's a scene that goes for a couple of minutes. They're very juicy. Liam and Phil and I are going to talk about them and unpack them together and interrupt the scene as we see fit, or just let it play. You guys are going to listen or watch along, and I hope you enjoy it.
And we'll be back after this quick break.
Man does love his couples from behind.
I want to talk about this match cut.
Yes.
Because I don't, it's actually one of the things I took a note on, right? Because like formally, Michael Mann is such a formalist. And like, one of the reasons I love The Insider so much, for example, is the wide angle close-ups of Wygand and his wife. It feels like, you know, you mentioned a religious filmmaker earlier. I think Michael Mann is a big Carl Theodore Dreyer fan in like his formalism and the frames and the way he frames things. And I just think that I don't have much to say beyond the fact that like the cut from the aisles to the two people with the music staying consistent throughout is just like movie nerd juice, right? It's the kind of thing that just, if you're aware of these things and you know what's going on, it's really powerful how cleanly that cuts. I also want to say that like one of the things that is so exciting about Michael Mann is how he grapples with the idea of like domesticity as it relates to also being a man, right? And obviously that's like a great theme in Heat and Insider and all of his work, but the fact that they're like, I love that the scene before this is in a grocery store and they're having this incredibly disturbing conversation. And that boy is amazing. And behind him is just like 12 varieties of Fruit Loops. Like it's the most banal kind of American image of like, which of your cereals do you want to get? And he's having this like existential nightmare conversation with his son, and how as a parent, sometimes those, you have incredibly deep and strange conversations with your children in weird places, right? And then it cuts into this scene where like he's talking to his wife sort of about what he has to do as a professional and as and in his role, and just the power of the cut from this like very pedestrian place to this like incredibly romantic lit kind of situation. There's power in that cut, and it tells you something about the story and where things are going. And I just think that like visually, he's pretty unimpeachable, Michael Mann.
Michael Mann's responsible for two of my favorite juxtapositions in the history of cinema. I wonder if you've ever, gone in deep on them. One of them is the one in Heat where it got cuts from, again, a scene of domesticity with him when Justine has sort of left all the dishes and Vincent comes home and he's kind of frustrated and he's sort of looking at the situation. And it's like, okay, my wife's starting to check out. My domestic situation's not great. Cut to fucking helicopter going across LA skyline. It's like, I'd rather be here. Like, you know, and that, but it tells you so much about the character psychology in the juxtaposition of those two images.
Yeah, he doesn't know what to do with dishes and domesticity, but he does know what to do with fucking helicopters.
So amazing about that, Phil, to your point, is that like, I'm channeling that image in my brain, right? Like I'm thinking about the shot. And the thing that's fascinating is that the final frame before it cuts to the helicopter, and literally I can remember this without pulling it up, is he has a hand on a shelf and another hand somewhere else. And he's sort of like splayed across the frame in this like tragic kind of pose before it cuts to the helicopter, right? And it's like this deceleration into a massive surge of energy, because like there's nothing sort of more pitiful for anyone than like something about Al Pacino washing dishes is so ridiculous. No, because he's like, no. he just kind of like does this with his hands, right? And then he's like, and it,
fuck this.
I would exactly,
I need to be in a helicopter.
I think man now. It's like, it's kind of a modernist masterpiece, that cut, because
I've never had that luxury feel. I just keep washing the fucking dishes, yeah, quietly.
Well, we don't all work for the NYPD, I mean the LAPD, but yeah, there's something about the way he's in this like tragic, like almost like a painting. It's like that frame is a painting before it cuts into the helicopter, and the helicopter stuff is so sort of handheld and like chaotic and exciting versus this like solid steady frame that you get when he finishes washing the dishes.
It's, I just want to tag quickly before we jump over to Phil, there's two things here. One is I want to tag on, like, despite the formalism, there's such a deep reality in you not having a choice when your kids want to have the deepest conversations of their lives.
Yes.
You don't have a choice of where that occurs. Whereas with your wife here, post dinner, post kid bedtime, staring out to a body of water, staring over a lake to, you know, to basically what looks like lights that have now kind of been in their sort of blur, kind of apportioned into the same sort of cans that would be on the shelves that we're surrounding. But yes, you're having this post bedtime conversation where it is actually, this is where we have a serious conversation. You can't choose that with a child, but here, bang, straight away. And I just immediately, you know, when we're talking about Heat, of course, in this moment, I'm thinking about Neil and Edie staring from Edie's absolutely ridiculously expensive apartment, which I now know exactly where it is, and there's no way that a waitress could afford it.
Yeah, dude.
but it's those two just looking out to a sea of lights. And in this one, it's not quite the, you know, the iridescent algae that Neil talks about, but it's certainly just this great framing device of these two people, and just their body language tells us everything. They're about to have a really tough conversation, you know,
staring into the unknown, isn't it? Right, like that he's about to face. You know, it's murky, it's blurry, it's potentially dangerous. You know, so I think it symbolizes that the route that he's about to go down as well.
Not only that, but the fact that earlier in the movie, there is the scene where he and Farina are sitting on the tree, right? Which is an iconic image from this movie. And they're having a serious conversation about the Tooth Fairy. And then his, you know, his wife doesn't think he's going down this road again. And then he has to go down this road again, right? Like, he has to sort of live that life again.
Yes.
And there's a quiet juxtaposition of Farina and the light at the beach. On, like, it feels like his life is a perpetual vacation because he's made a choice to escape this life that he now has to go back into. And instead, we're seeing it in the dark, right? It's, like, we've also entered this descent.
It's also the classical man motif of reflective moments next to water.
Yeah.
Right. Which happens a lot in The Insider. What the big pivotal decision scene is with the fuck it, let's go to court scene, as I recall, I think is by a body of water. Obviously, the many, many scenes with Neil in Heat, you know, in his apartment looking out at the ocean. It's a classic man motif as well.
And and similarly, yeah, Katie Walsh asked Michael Mann that question on at our live Q&A. And he said, it's an affliction that I suffer. It's a self projection. When I'm trying to figure something out, stare into the ocean.
Yeah.
Figure it out. And he's given that gift to his characters, this great contemplation. All right, let's keep playing.
So where are things?
Nowhere. Everything we've tried is either a dead end or it's backfired. Crawford's already planning the next crime scene so that we get it fresh. We've got about 6 more days till the next full moon.
Can you quit?
No.
I think that's a really interesting moment, if I can just pin down on that, because I think it has a different meaning. Can you quit? It doesn't necessarily mean, like, could he quit? Yes. Like, in terms of, like, pragmatics.
Yes.
But can you, your soul, Will Graham, the motor that drives you, the fire in your chest, can that quit?
Can you quit?
No, That's different. Do you know what I mean?
That's different.
I think you feel that nuance through the performance. So it's not a banal question, you know. So I just wanted to flag that. I think that's like just important to the essence of this character.
I also just want to go back to 1 hour 9 minutes 7 seconds. We've really seen the peak of both summer and winter attire from both of these people. You know,
the fits in this movie.
The fits.
I just want to say one of the best dressed 80s movies.
William Peterson is about as hot as they come at this period. You know, like good
snack.
Lord.
Snack Peterson. Snack Peterson.
That's actually his nickname. Yeah, that's what they call him.
That's what Michael called him. It's just this great, but I just love this. I love pregnant pauses that you could fly a plane through, and this is one of them just here.
Crawford's already planning the next crime scene so that we get it fresh.
I love that. We're now looking at a close-up where she's basically occupying the frame. Such a beautiful thing. You see the knit on her sweater. Kim Grice, she's so great as Molly.
6 more days till the next full moon.
Big earrings.
Can you quit?
The backlight is incredible.
Yeah. The lights from the house, there's almost like police floodlights. They're almost like they're at their own crime scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. And then he turns away.
So this is key to me when he turns, exactly, the turn away. And I don't, he looks at her again, but it's sort of, the next time he looks at her, if I remember correctly, is the statement of purpose. Yeah. Is the kind of like, I have to do this. And then when we get there, I want to talk about her reaction because it like blew my mind.
Yeah. He's so wonderful here. And it's an hour, 9 minutes, 23 seconds just to see this frame. It's so sensational. But here we go. I love just the subtlety.
Mm-hmm.
Biting her tongue. She's just biting her tongue. Like right now you can see this like little tiny, it's almost imperceptible movement. She's just like chewing down a sentence, chewing down a response because she knows that he is fragile. You know, despite being the tough man, he's so fragile in this moment.
You know, the thing that I think is always so fascinating, you know, whenever people talk about Michael Mann, and they often talk about Heat, and they often talk about the coffee shop. And if you do some research, you know that he had two cameras trained on Pacino and De Niro, and it's largely the same take. It's largely the same take from you know, it's take 11. I think I read. Blake, you probably know better.
Take 11.
But what's beautiful...
thanks to Tom Rolfe, I learned from Billy Goldenberg, who's an Academy Award winning editor. It was actually his first movie. Tom Rolfe was a senior editor on that scene, and they had cut what they thought were their favorite bits in originally assembling that scene. And when they watched it, they said it was ghastly because it didn't match. And they recut the whole scene. Tom Rolfe recut it with Billy to take 11. They just said, it's got to be the same take. And they did it and they presented it to Michael and it didn't change.
And I think there's something like holy about that decision because it is honoring the performance and the value of performance and the idea that Pacino and De Niro are so locked in, you know, define locked in. It's a picture of Al Pacino and Robert De Niro in that scene.
It's Federer and Nadal.
Right.
Yeah, you're watching the fucking best who've ever done this go toe to toe, and it's a rally.
And
it's like in fucking, it's like fifth set Wimbledon.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That's what you're watching
of technique as well as
technique. And one moves a finger, and the other observes it. And you might not see it. Some of this shit is imperceptible, you know. But like, it's there. It's like it's present and. It's that whole, that thing, that classic Godard quote of like, every film is a documentary about its actors. And beyond documenting the story that Michael Mann is telling, he's documenting two actors at the peak level of their performance doing this incredible thing. And I bring it up in the context of this scene because shooting, you know, making a film and doing these close-ups of people having a conversation is actually about as hard as it gets to make it feel as though people are, at, you know, shots taken hours apart, maybe days apart, you know, different setups, people are exhausted, the lighting has changed. To capture that reality in the way that he does, it's so special because it does feel like we're, maybe it is the same take. I mean, I don't think they were shooting that way, but it feels absolutely like one piece of continuity. Yeah. Going through the whole thing.
What's next?
I love that she just says, "What's next? Can you quit? No. Bite down the reaction. What's next?
I go to Atlanta.
Crawford?
No. I have to be alone.
You're talking about doing exactly what you said you...
This killing, it's got to stop.
Stop.
He's such the architect of his own self-destruction here. He's just, it's a great Michael Mann and great just, it's a great noir trope. It's a great fiction trope. It's just like, you're telling me you're breaking your one rule.
Have you guys read In the Blink of an Eye, Walter Murch's book about video editing?
No, haven't.
So it's the best book about filmmaking I've ever read. Changed my life. Like, completely and totally changed the way that I thought about filmmaking. I read
Walter Murch, heard of him.
Yeah. He's pretty good. But he, in that book, you know, some of it is sort of about the process of editing, but a lot of it is about his methodology for editing. And one thing that, you know, he has this like dichotomy, this list of like how he makes a cut. Right. The first thing is the emotion. The second thing is the story. The third thing is the continuity. Like it's a list, you know, and I used to teach it when I taught editing. But the like sort of big takeaway from the book is that when you're editing a movie, the way the actors blink impacts when and where you cut.
Mm.
And I watched this bit, just her reaction to his speech, like three times last night. In preparation for this, and she blinks four times.
Let's have a look.
What's next?
One, two.
Well, that right after he gives the speech. Yeah. Oh, she has these like reactive.
Crawford.
No.
We can talk
I'll
over.
Tell
it.
You one. Yeah. Sorry. So after he pushes the, after he talks about doing like method actor serial killer stuff, and he has this like speech.
You're talking about doing exactly what you said you
was killing.
Yeah, he hits it right. He hits it right on that fourth blink.
Yeah, yeah. And then, and then watch
it's
this.
It's got to stop.
Her eyes dance. She's trying to read him. One, two, three. I said, and then the fourth one. And I am so blown away by that because there's, There is you're not
Dove Honig. Dove Honig.
You're not watching you're watching a performance, but you're watching someone like take in the worst information they can. And you know, this is a huge part of Murch's book. The eyes move around when someone is thinking and trying to interpret and solve a problem. That's what our eyes do, right? That's why they move when we sleep. They're like processing information. And then the blinks, each one to me. And I don't know what the story is, but they tell a different story about the way that this is impacting her. Yeah. Right. And like one would think that like maybe in that moment she becomes resigned to the fact that she's not stopping her husband from leaving. But the fact that man doesn't cut back to his quote protagonist, he stays with her. It kind of it makes the scene about her.
Yes.
But he does it with like six or seven blinks over the course of the 2.5 minute scene or whatever it happens to be. And like. The honoring of that reaction, I think, really relates to this larger conversation about like honoring the performance and capturing the performance and letting that tell you the story.
There's a bit here, Bill, I want to hear what you have to say about it, which is when she resigns to the fact.
What's next?
And then he says, what's next?
I go to Atlanta.
Crawford?
No. I have to be alone.
That, all that business. All right, we've just paused it on an hour 9:41. All that business. I have to go to Atlanta. It's a direction. It's an objective. It's super clear. And then I have to be, and he does this like, it's like his body is tensing up and scrunching and have to be
alone. Like just everything, the waves of that going over his face. It's almost like he's preparing his body for what he has to do. I can't get enough of that.
I have some big thoughts on this. Yes. That are more macro than the micro.
Yeah, go macro.
You know, well, macro, there's a few things going on. This is such a, these two scenes, one of the reasons I was so excited about it was that they're so key structurally. But what I think is going on within the immediacy of the scene is he has a cosmic connection with this killer, right? That is very hard to wrap your hands around and hard to explain because it's purely in the spheres. It's purely in ephemera. It takes someone with his level of mental strength and mental intensity to have that connection. And I think that's why, and you'll see this in this later scene, you see it throughout the movie, Will Graham is frequently reaching with his hand to touch windows often or other surfaces, but frequently windows, because he's sort of a window into this other character's mind and heart and soul. And he's reaching out to connect with this, his dark mirror image, another Mannian kind of theme, right? Especially what you think of Heat, right? That's a less, you know, Macaulay is a much more likable character than Dolarhyde, right? But there's an element of these two, you know, your dark inversion, and he's reaching out for it. And that's why it's so symbolic, I think, that when he smashes through the window in the final confrontation, it's the shattering of that process. So what he's really, in order for him to do that, he loves Molly deeply, but he's also trying to sort of, if you look at his acting throughout the scene, he's slowly and incrementally disengaging from her because he's saying this is a very personal and vulnerable and solitary process that there can't be no domestic intrusion. I can't be in the middle of this. And then you come in and go, this bill hasn't been paid and we need to deal with, right? It's like the level of, for me as a writer, this is something I really, to a greatly lesser extent, it's something I really understand because as a writer, you're sculpting worlds out of the ether, you know, and creating all of these buildings and creating all of these characters and these, you know, societies and, you know, all this stuff. And then someone knocks on the door and goes, do you want a cup of tea? You're like, yeah. As in the words of Jack Nicholson in The Shining, you're breaking my concentration, right? Like, there's that, you create this bubble.
Well, it's not bad.
You. Yeah, not bad.
Know? So I think that's what's interesting in the conflict and the tension of the scene. She realizes in the expressions that Liam was just talking about, I think where you see her eyes, her pupils darting as she's studying him and realizing, you're slipping away from me here. You're moving from Will Graham, my loving husband, to Will Graham, the, you know, psychic empathizer. And I realize I'm no longer basically in this equation. And this scene, and so structurally as well, what's going on in the scene is, you know, in classic Joseph Campbell, you know, I've read all the Joseph Campbell, so sometimes I find it a bit, some of it's a bit impenetrable and a bit dry, but it's, you know, it's nonetheless useful to kind of have some kind of grasp on it. But this whole film, to me, struck me, again, just zooming out, going a little bit more macro, it's classic sort of like the knight that is offered the quest to slay the dragon, literally.
Yeah.
Right? The monster is out there. You're the classic first scene, refusal of the call. You're the only one who can slay this monster. I don't want to slay it. I've been a knight. I've got my scars. I'm good. I'm out now. No, you're the only one that can get this particular monster. And he's eating villages. You know, it's all these type of classic mythic, ideas and foundations are underneath and resonating underneath all of this on a subconscious level. And so this scene is key because it's like him saying, I now have to go into the dark cave. In order to find where that cave is, I have to use my psychic abilities that are unique to me because of the way I can think, which is such an personal, isolatory process. But this scene is, you know, I'm approaching that cave, but I have to go in alone. It's not safe. I can't take anyone else with me. So
I can't even take you with me in my heart.
Absolutely not. In any way, I have to detach from you. But so what he's saying, and he goes on to say, is very like pragmatic, and it's go to your not to jump ahead, but you know,
yeah, well, let's
yeah, we'll wait for it. Yeah,
we can do a director's commentary right now.
Yeah.
You're talking about doing exactly what you said you
this killing. It's got to stop.
That's all he cares about.
And his eyes have never been more piercing. It's got to stop.
I'm hunting this thing. I can smell him, you know. He's on the trail.
This made me want to smoke.
Yeah, this whole movie is problematic.
Days That End in Y make me want to smoke. God yeah. damn it. You're going to have to take some.
I love shooting. My children while we're on the subject.
I love my children. I love them so much. Dad will not smoke. And in Australia, it's like it's a way to make yourself broke. But oh man, alive.
Oh, man.
Oh, okay, let's get back to the scene.
Deep breaths.
Deep breaths.
Put their Z-packs in.
Everyone, take another little bit of Nicorette gum.
Also, they enter each other's frame in this moment, which I think is it becomes a two, right? At least on her and him.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. The choice of the cigarette is interesting, right? Because it's like, look, we're still in this together. We're stepping outside of this reality for a second. We're still in this together as a partnership, but I am going to need to isolate William, and separate you to complete the quest.
Yeah. It's and there is something, I know this is dumb because we were just talking about smoking in jest, but why people find it difficult to quit, speaking as a person who has, is there is something so underrated about just fucking breathing, you know? Inhale, exhale. And she just breathes. Part of the secret is just like, breathe, like let's recalibrate your brain, breathe. And then she's about to say something. And the preparation is that taking a couple of deep breaths before you respond to anything is like an advice thing. It's a rote, crappy piece of advice. But I feel like it rings so true here because she's like, literally, I'm going to have a puff of this cigarette. I'm just going to breathe for a second and then I'm going to respond. And the response is so important. So we can just play it and then we'll come back in just a second.
William, you're going to make yourself sick or get yourself killed.
It's just, it's just truth, right?
it's just truth, let's stop
dancing around the bullshit. Here's the fucking truth. And I'm going to use your full name like a mother would to a child. Not Will, William.
William.
That's what you say when it's like, hey, you know, you really need to take it to the next level. It's disciplinarian almost, but she doesn't, the acting performance isn't disciplinarian. It's just like, I need to cut through the mental fog that you're clearly enveloped in and be like, this is the hard reality, right? Yeah. I get it. You're committed to this and there are lives at stake but this will be the consequences. And I need you to hear that.
Yes.
You know,
and so also like, and then we're at 1 hour, 10 minutes and 25 seconds. When you cut and it is a two shot, you're looking at her, you're maintaining her gaze from the previous close up where she's dropped this truth bomb and you're watching the resonant fallout, right? Like, which is him just going, she is 100% right. You are going to make yourself sick or you are going to get yourself killed. They are the only outcomes. And I think the nicest thing we can say is that, like, she's right. He does make himself sick. And I think
almost
the theatrical, absolutely almost gets killed. I was sort of half lightly chuckling to myself before when you're like, when he smashes through the window and he collapses this Jungian mirror of these two things. One of the funniest things in a Michael Mann movie is just Francis just catches him. He's so
immediately
big,
he gets catches
him like a child and throws him.
What's interesting about this shot as well, he's already in Atlanta. Look at his face. He's not there.
No, yeah, he's
in his mind. He's gone. Will he's already like gone. He's down the fucking freeway.
Yeah.
You know, can I just make a sartorial comment, which is bring back two collars? Like contrasting collars.
Contrasting
I just used to be a thing
collars.
I would do is I would wear a button down with a collared shirt under it. And my wife was like, that's a bit much. And I'm like, not if you've seen Manhunter.
I'll send you the screenshot for your wife. Excuse me. You just hold your phone up.
Hottest two people that have ever lived, one's wearing two collars. So.
Oh, God. Yeah. He can't look at her.
Can't look at her. He's rejecting her in this moment.
You and Kevin should go to Montana.
You should go to Montana. as far away as humanly possible from me and this.
Mm-hmm. So your dad, he hasn't seen Kevin for a long time.
So what I love about this is the disparity between the kindness and compassion of what he's saying, which is, I love you and I love Kevin. And, is thinking about the father as well. He hasn't seen them for a long time. These are three people in my extended family or my immediate family that I deeply love and really care about. But the way he's saying it, and because he's looking in the total opposite direction,
is the opposite,
I don't care about this at this point. So the practical information is deeply compassionate, but the way that it's conveyed is completely, for an empath that he is, completely unempathetic.
I need to literally divorce myself from you guys right now. And you need to be in proximity. You need to be as far away from me as possible so that I can, so that my tuning fork can have its most, can capture the biggest area of frequency or whatever it is.
And I'll come up and get you afterwards.
And she's just...
Yeah, she knows it's gone. I've lost him. I've lost him.
Another blink. The camera moves in that wide for the first... Or to into it. It's a new shot.
Mist rolling off the water.
Oh, it's a great shot, Michael Mann.
Guy's got moves.
He does this shit good. Is that good? Look at that.
Every frame's the most beautiful painting you've ever seen, isn't it? You know, just the depth of field, the composition, the multiple layers of input.
And the light, the massive flood light that's here that's been beautifully lighting Will, and then you got the backlight at the house there, and you got the lights in the house, and then the porch light. It's the dark
forest, isn't it? Again, in classic mythological terms, we're on the edge. We're sort of in the dark forest. There's a city over there that we've sort of seen, but I'm in that innermost cave, and I now need to shed the shackles that bind me to normal domestic civilization and head deeper and deeper into the sort of point of no return,
This is it.
Classical stuff.
I make my wife do this scene every time before we record every episode of Die Hard.
Yeah. So you guys see. This podcasting, it's got to continue.
You better go into the next room with the kids.
Exactly.
I'll come get you.
See your dad. I haven't seen them.
You're doing an episode about turbulence. Chill out.
It's terminal velocity, Phil. Just what's the big deal?
Tachinsky is important to me.
It matters. Damn it.
Come on.
And then this great,
we all get it.
This great solitude is then perfectly offset. Straight cut.
Yes.
Airport in the rain. And so his hand is first on the glass as you see their plane, what we assume is their plane, going to Montana. Sorry, I can't come to the phone right now. And I love that touch too, because then he remembers from the opening scene in the Leeds house, the sound of Valerie Leeds' voice on the answering machine. And at the time in the episode with Lindsay Romaine that folk are going to hear for scene 3, part 2, we ask the question, who is on that phone? Who is calling? Is it a friend? Is a loved one just wanting to hear their voice? Is it someone who's not been able to get access to the house because it's still an active crime scene? Is it Frances calling back to hear her voice? Mm. We're never going to know. But in this moment, it makes me think that it's Frances, because he starts hearing her voice as his family are flying away. That the connections of the family that has been lost and that he's losing his family is echoing on the score with this little note. It is a absolutely overstuffed piece of cinema right here. It's like the full power of the spectrum of the image, of the characterization of the inference, and then tying back to another note in the movie. It's just all working, firing on all cylinders.
Bong Joon-ho gif, essentially, to me, that's cinema, I wanted to comment on the fact that I think what's so kind of amazing about the kind of like quality of this frame, because you know, you wrote when you sent the note, you were like, it's a coffee shop. And of course it's a coffee shop, but it's a coffee shop in an airport, right? And the yes. choice to just play the like flight 90s, you know, the kind of yeah. like you instantly are situated so well in this moment. And we don't need like an explication of what's next and where we are now. It's Phil, it's not all that different from Dirty Dishes to Helicopter, but it's yeah. much more interior.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I wasn't totally, I thought, is this a coffee shop? Because it the choice to not establish the location is really interesting and obviously very not accidental, right? We don't actually really fully see this environment because the environment's not actually that important. What's important is the spheres that he's reaching out towards.
Yeah.
Right. The darkness that he's reaching to connect with in order to get the monster. The actual location is less important than his psychological state because I've now shed those other things I don't need. Now I can focus on the darkness, right. You know, and he's looking into and tellingly seeing himself, which is what Lecter has said to him. Right. If you want the scent, smell yourself and all of that stuff. He's looking into that, you know, the dark inversion and he's seeing, am I bit evil myself? Well, that's a very trivial way to put it, but do I contain this darkness to a degree that the degree that Lecter is saying I do, or is this just my, you know,
I think he knows that it's there.
Skill.
What's the next line? Just me and you now, sport. And it kind of feels like he's talking to himself as much as he's talking to Lecter.
Yeah.
After he says coffee. I also
coffee's
want
coffee. Important, by the way. Coffee's our friend.
Coffee and a cigarette.
Coffee and a pack of cigarettes.
Oh my god! I'm like, I just went somewhere else for a few minutes for like 3 seconds.
Back to time in my life when I was less cautious about these things.
Coffee is dangerous.
Just you and me now, sport.
I mean, watching this last night, I was like, he's talking to himself. I mean, obviously, he's talking to the Tooth Fairy, right? But he's talking to himself. He's alone. Right,
just you and to his dark passenger.
Yes.
The
yes.
voice that guides him and taps him into that the world right. of the dollar hides and the red dragons and the monsters that, you know,
because it doesn't matter who they are. He's like, it's mm-hmm. that in Highlander there can be only one, right? He's just he can smell I've got you, I'm on your scent, and it's my scent. Like it's almost like whatever affliction that he has, he see them. It's like you can only see those people. It's like they register on his infrared frequency, mm-hmm. and he can see them. And it's just this. Oh man, that's so good. This cut from there to here mm-hmm. to close up, just pure
in the
reflection.
Mirror pure world. Reflection. He's in the mirror world.
Just you and me now, sport.
The flashing red light.
I'm gonna find you, God.
Danger, danger, alert, alert, you know. Red, very semiotic.
And the score. Score is just upping, 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 upping.
But then what happens in the rest of it, you know, we're going not to, because it's not our place. We know we have to stop exactly at that time code. But just to conclude this, you know, in terms of zooming back again to the macro, this is the end of this section of Will Graham's story, because then mm-hmm. there is this really interesting structural decision to pivot to the villain of the piece in very rudimentary terms, which is done also in Silence of the Lambs, but it's quite innovative and rare to, because we're so immersed in Will Graham's psychology throughout. We've been so in, it feels like he's in every scene. I know there's one or two Dollar Hyde scenes or the lounge stuff, right, where he gets lounge, you get into Dollar Hyde's reality a bit there, but it's sort of a brief sequence. For the most part, we're totally with Will. This is the culmination of that section of his journey before it's the final showdown.
Oh, we're running downhill from here. It's the fastest 50 minutes almost in movies. It just
You know, I said earlier in this conversation that this is one of the most influential movies ever made. And I think it's influential for a couple reasons. It has like a procedural quality that like true crime podcasts would copy forever. Like I think Man kind of like helped bring the dense, real procedural into the mainstream, especially as it talks about like weirdo serial killers who like have giant dragon tattoos. Like he gets into the lurid side of it just enough, right? And he also has the procedural quality. And actually I would say that the decision to cut at the hour 11 minute mark to the villain and spend time there feels a little bit like going from one episode of a podcast to another. Like suddenly we're in this new story, this new side of the story. What almost no one has been able to do is bring the romantic and horrifying and beautiful, like cinematic energy that he brings to this movie to almost any other true crime kind of element. It has that like vision that I think there's a lot of like infotainment about serial killers. None of them get to this level of poetry. Even well, the no, Silence of the Lambs, which is a movie.
There's no Zodiac
I like.
Without this, but Zodiac, yes. I think, is a very sober movie.
Yes.
Zodiac
yes.
loves the procedural details. And it's one of the things that makes it, it's just like, a, you know,
but it does have a manhunt. Tumbling. It does have a manhunt at moment. It's the basement.
Right. The That's one of the great moments in that movie.
It's as manhunter as it gets in that fucking basement. Yeah. Yeah.
But I would go so far as to say that this is the best procedural ever made, the most cinematic procedural ever made, because it and the other thing about that, and you know, and these scenes do touch on it, but the whole movie's about thinking.
Yeah,
it's about it, at its core, it's about him. I have to think. I can't shoot my way. I know it resolves itself in a shootout, but to get to that point, it had to. It's all thought. And the way that they like when they get the intercept Lecter's note, you've got a bunch of smart guys going, well, he would do this, or it would be this. Well, it's not the Bible because of this, or he'd look to find a way to do it so that this wouldn't happen. And he did. They're all just, it's all thought and projection. It's you know, which is just so fascinating because it's so intangible. You know, it's like, how do you film thought? Well, I'm Michael Mann, bitch. Look at this.
I think that might have to be the end. I don't know if we're gonna top on Michael Mann, bitch. Gentlemen, thank you so much for doing the show. It's a real pleasure.
Honor. Can we do another one?
An honor and a
you
pleasure.
You come back and talk in the Inner Gutter DeVita episode if you like, if you feel so inclined.
I just want to hang out with you.
Oh, I want to hang out with you guys so much. It's pretty devastating. I would just say to all the people listening, you might be getting sick of it as you're hearing about it, but so many of these folks are people that I've seen after a recent trip to LA where I got to meet a lot of them in person for the first time. And it's been an incredible journey to meet them again. And every time I feel very, very pleased and happy and like overwhelmed. And I also feel very sad because I'm like, last time I saw this person, I could just grab them and hug them and thank them for everything. And so it's great. It's great seeing you both. And thank you for coming to do this dance. You've taken me into your show. I'm so happy and proud to be a part of it. Thanks for letting me talk about David Strathairn, for a long time.
My Kevin mom's Bacon. Favorite, by the way. That's my mom's.
Your mom has impeccable taste.
Biggest crush. Look, I totally get that, Blake. And you know, we'll always have the Blue Room, my friend. We'll always have that magical night.
we'll have a pretty magical night. Yeah, it... Yeah, we'll have the screening too. We'll have the screening.
Oh my god!
Into the Blue Room. That's what we'll have.
Shit, transcendent stuff.
But we were more drunk in the Blue Room, so
yeah, we were.
But it's different vibes.
No joke. Phil posted that video when the Miami Vice music came on. I was like, oh yeah, that happened.
Yeah.
Whoever put that on is a genius. So
yeah, it was very good. It was very good.
Michael Mann.
It definitely wasn't the Yacht Rock party Nate. That we were there with. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Plug away on Die Hard on a Blank to close out the show.
When does this come out?
This will be out-ish as people are listening to it. November.
So in November on the podcast, we have... where is my release date? Well, we have a bunch of... Oh my goodness, I can't find the right spot. Sorry, guys. In November, we will have Air Force One.
Wow.
The day after the United States presidential election.
Of course.
We drop our episode on Air Force One. I think we can say who our guests are. Our guests are Dom Nero and Adam Volarich of Eye of the Duck returning. They're our Harrison Ford correspondents, it turns out. So they're coming back for that. And then on November 20th, we have The Jackal.
Oh.
Bruce Willis's...
Oh, you don't have to talk to me. Sidney Poitier, Di Benora. Yeah.
Heel turn.
Richard Gere and the worst IRA accent of all time. Yeah.
Yes. And then the other thing I should say very quickly is that in late October, we release our episode on John Woo's Face Off.
Oh, my goodness.
With special guest Isaac Butler, author of The Method, who is returning to talk about the most over-the-top performances in action movie history.
Our guru on acting, because that's the angle that we're going to approach it. And I think we should just say, for because I would hate to be so arrogant as to assume that anyone actually knows what Die Hard on a Blank is.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Very, very briefly, the whole show is dedicated to the influence of Die Hard on action cinema, one action movie at a time. And we go in chronological order from Die Hard onwards. Roadhouse, License to Kill, Die Hard 2, and then all of these different Toy Soldiers, which was sort of the first one, and then so on and so forth, for all of these films that haven't contained some kind of Die Hard DNA or some kind of Die Hard connection. The one we did with Blake was River Wild, which was a bit of a reach, but we felt met the criteria.
Reach away.
We've done Heat, which was another really interesting comparison piece, Cop and a Thief, L.A., sometimes the connections are a little bit more tangential, and sometimes they're straight. Your Passenger 57s, your Under Sieges, and all of that. But the idea of the show is that when it's completed, we will have definitively tracked Die Hard's influence across the action genre, and that's the sort of that's the thesis of the show.
Also, it's a podcast about Tenet. Just saying.
He can't help himself. Folks, thank you. Folks, thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of Mindhunter when we see one Francis Dolarhyde and his lovely new lady petting sedated tiger. Latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern Mann movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there. And the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon / One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron, for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Mindhunter episode, Mindhunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods, or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.